DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum. My name is Connor Dillon. You know, once in a while there's a week where the science news that really grabs people's attention and also grabs our attention here at Deutsche Welle, it all seems to have a theme. It's kind of like the science community decided, well, you know what, we're just going to talk about ABC or XYZ this week, and that's all we're going to talk about. And this was one of those weeks. So over the last roughly 7 to 10 days, that theme was birds. And it was actually even more specific than that, because a couple of the studies that we're going to talk about and that were very interesting to a lot of people this week were about a specific kind of bird called the finch. Now, finches are generally about the size of your fist, if you bunch up your fist for a second. And they come in all sorts of shapes and varieties and sizes because they live all over the world and have, of course, evolved in many different ways depending on their local environments. But basically, wherever you live, you have probably seen a finch, unless you live in the polar regions. They're not there. Now, it turns out, though, that there's something that zebra finches do that's kind of eerily similar to what we humans do. And what they do is they end their sentences, their birdsong sentences, if you will, on a long syllable. But the question is why? I had a chance to speak with two researchers. They're from the University of McGill in Montreal, Canada. And what they've been doing is they've been teaching baby zebra finches a kind of hacked or remixed or jumbled up version of the bird songs that they would typically be learning from their fathers. And the results are really fascinating. Here's John Cicada. He's a biology professor and the head of the Cicada Songbird Lab.
So we have them raised. There's a mother and a father. They have eggs. They have a clutch. And then when the chicks are born, both mother and mom and dad are there to feed the young. But after about a week, less than a week, we take out the father, and it's just mom or a foster mom takes care of the kids. And that's because we want to make sure that the juveniles that we're raising are not exposed to song during this sensitive period in development. And then when the chicks are able to feed themselves, we put them individually in a sound attenuating chamber, which is basically an experimental box. And then there, the juveniles are able to tutor themselves by what they're housed individually, and they have these perches that they can jump onto, and when they jump on the perch, it activates a playback of a song. This is a song that we've synthesized from our stimuli, but this is modeled after typical zebra finch song. And it's a stereotyped sequence of sounds. So it and so there's a stereotyped sequence in which he produces these vocal elements, these sounds, and that's again this trademark of the zebra finch songs, this stereotyped sequencing that we see.
Okay, so that was the linear sequence, as Professor Cicada calls it. Now, he also sent me a file that was called the random sequence. This is the jumbled up version, or the mixtape, if you will, of the bird song. And so that is what you're about to hear next, and then Professor Cicada is going to explain to us what we are hearing.
These are the same sounds, but now in each of the motifs that we create, the sequencing of those sounds varies, and it varies randomly. So it's hard to hear, but there is sort of this loud and long burp syllable, and in the first rendition, when it's linear, you hear it at the end of the song. It goes bitter-doop, bitter-doop, bitter-doop. And here, that syllable comes at sort of different parts of the song. So, for example, in the first phrase or motif of the song, it's in the middle, and in the third one, it's at the beginning, and in the fourth one, it's second to the last. And so the position of that particular sound varies from rendition to rendition. And so that in that respect, the sequencing of the sounds is randomized across these versions, and importantly, it's unpredictable.
Okay, so what does the result of all this training in the juvenile zebra finches sound like after they've grown up listening to these mixed up jumbled sounds? Well, that is what we are going to listen to next. And these sounds, the results, are going to be explained to us by Logan James. He's a PhD student under John Sakata, and he's studying the mechanisms underlying the control and plasticity of syllable sequencing.
Yeah, so it's hard to pick up because these birds are singing their songs like remarkably fast. But what you can hear is he sings these four syllables in a row, and then he pauses for a second, and then he sings it again. So, you know, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And those four syllables that he's producing are really sort of in an order that we found was actually very typical. So he starts with this kind of slightly longer element, and he ends with his longest element, and the higher pitched syllables are in the middle there. And so, yeah, this bird is one of the ones that really followed the pattern quite remarkably. One little example we thought of that was sort of parallel with the birds that we have is that, you know, the ends of our phrases tend to be longer. So if you listen to the length of the end of the sentence, if I say the sentence, I studied birds, and then if I now say the birds were studied, the length of that word birds is actually quite a bit longer. I mean, it's subtle, but it is longer when it's at the end versus the middle. So I studied birds, the birds were studied. And even the word studied there is also different. We know in the middle, I studied birds. It's shorter than at the end, the birds were studied.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
A lot of languages have these sort of common speech patterns. So, for example, this phrase final elongation, a lot of languages have this phenomenon. And one of the questions is that, is this sort of speech pattern, is it rooted in something biological or is it rooted in something cultural? And I think it's difficult to really test that question in humans. And so we're able to really isolate a biological component in songbirds by having careful experimental control about their developmental experiences. And our study seems to suggest that these sort of common patterns that you see in birds has a biological foundation, and we think maybe that could be the case as well in humans.
And that was John Sakata and Logan James at McGill University in Montreal, Canada. But you know what? They are not the only ones studying zebra finches. Zebra finches are actually a very commonly studied bird for a number of reasons, but I'll let my colleague Brigitte Osterrat tell you more about that. She went to a research aviary just outside of Munich here in southern Germany to find out why researchers there are strapping teeny tiny backpacks onto some of the 2,000 zebra finches there. You are about to get that answer from a zebra finch itself with this bird's eye view told by Charlotte Lomas.
Welcome to my world. I am a bird, more specifically a zebra finch. My species originates from Australia and Indonesia, but I hatched here at the Max Planck Institute for Ornithology in Germany. I live together with a dozen of my kind in a spacious indoor aviary. We zebra finches enjoy each other's company, and we love to sit together on big branches hanging down from the ceiling that have been installed here for us. Oh, that's it for now. Here's one of my researchers arriving. His name is Wolfgang Forstmeier.
Zebra finches are kind of like the lab rats of birds. They're easy to keep and to breed. The good thing is that they're comfortable in the captive surroundings that we offer them here. They're very sociable. They also sit close to each other in the wild as well.
I've heard people say that we're also quite beautiful birds. As a female zebra finch, I have grey plumage, a white breast and bottom, some white-black markings on my face, and an orange beak. The males, though, have red beaks, orange cheek patches, throat stripes, a black bar on their chest, and chestnut-brown flanks with white spots. Choosing a male partner among these handsome chaps is sometimes hard. And just imagine, our research has put a lot of effort into finding out how we females do it.
We painted the males, for example, painting their orange cheeks black or making their breast bar bigger. But we didn't see any effect at all. We simply haven't discovered a concept of ideal beauty amongst those birds. I think they just don't care about visual appearances.
Typical humans, they're so superficial. Of course we don't care about things like that. Why should we? Much more interesting for us female zebra finches is how well a male can sing. Just listen to this guy. Doesn't he sound beautiful? Singing appears to be a bit of work for the males. I've seen and heard young boys practice their songs over and over again before they sound even remotely acceptable. Listen to this cute fellow. He's just 25 days old. A terrible noise, isn't it?
He simply doesn't know how to sing. He sounds like a door whose hinges need to be oiled. It'll take another 70 to 80 days until he really knows how to sing, until he finds the rhythm and he manages the modulation and has command over his singing organ.
This is Lisa Forst, another one of my researchers. She's interested in communication among birds. As a female zebra finch, it's easy for me. I don't sing at all. But that doesn't mean I'm silent. Quite the opposite. We zebra finches communicate a lot with each other, using short calls a few thousand times a day. We're constantly telling each other where we are, who we are, and what we're doing. And it's important when living in such big groups like ours. I don't know why, but humans like Lisa Forst were baffled by those calls.
Was beide gemeinsam haben, beide Geschlechter, ist, dass sie diese...
Both males and females produce those different types of short calls. They're hereditary, they don't have to learn them. They use those calls incredibly often. So we were wondering, what's behind all of it? Do these calls have any meaning? Or do they just keep on calling because they feel bored or something?
Because we feel bored? Ridiculous. This is when it becomes a bit uncomfortable for us. Lisa and her team designed small backpacks that they put on us from time to time. They tell us they're microphones to record the individual sounds we make, to eavesdrop on us.
Und die Vögel haben das quasi im Rücken.
The birds have it on their back with the microphone directly on their skin. One strap of the bag goes around this leg, the other strap around the other leg. The smaller the bird is, the thinner the thread has to be. Otherwise, the birds don't like it. But they do get used to the bag packs quite quickly.
Well, what other choice do we have? Fortunately, we can get rid of these things soon enough. But I am left wondering what the researchers learn from eavesdropping on us.
Shortly before she calls, the number of his calls increases, afterwards as well. That means he answers when she calls and vice versa. And we've found out that only pairs within a group do that. Those birds have a relationship with one another.
Well, I could have told you that, Lisa, if only you'd asked me. But admittedly, communication with humans is quite difficult. So I guess there are many more experiments to come. There's just so much about us birds that humans still don't know.
Now, finches, which is what we've been talking about up to this point, they are mostly resident birds, meaning they do not migrate. But every autumn, vast numbers of other songbirds do migrate from Europe to Africa, and many of them use the island of Cyprus as a place to rest and feed and to kind of hang out. But the problem is, many of these birds never ever leave Cyprus because they're caught and killed by poachers. Now, police on a British military base on the island have launched their latest weapon in the fight against these illegal bird trappers. It's a high-tech drone. Nathan Morley has more.
This impressive device does things that no regular crime fighter can. From 200 meters high, it can spot poachers even in the remotest and most rugged parts of the countryside.
DJI, it's made in China. This is the Matrice 200. It's one of the latest in technology, and with every modern police force...
I'm at the British military base in eastern Cyprus, where police here are showing me their latest weapon in the fight against rampant bird trapping. We've seen a scenario where this new drone tracked and filmed poachers who were setting up mist nets. Naturalist and broadcaster Chris Packham is also here. He's long campaigned against the illegal slaughter of birds on the island.
Obviously, I'm very keen to see any forms of technology that can be used to enforce the law out here, because the law's been broken for a long time. Drones, as we know, are an effective means of doing that.
And it's an effective means that the police here are looking for. Figures last year showed that over 2 million migrating birds were trapped and killed on the island. Most of the trapping takes place here, within the British military-controlled areas around Decalia. That's prompted this rather creative but costly solution. Chris Packham again.
I mean, this is an expensive piece of kit. It's not come cheap. It works at night. It's got very, very good resolution on the camera. If this drone and this tool is used properly, I think it could definitely contribute to monitoring and securing convictions.
Cyprus is officially the second most deadly bird destination in the Mediterranean after the tiny island of Malta. The situation has generated so much bad publicity that authorities here are under pressure to act. Marcus Petru is an inspector from the British base's police force at Decalia.
We have the obligation to deal with these situations. Bird trapping is banned, so we need to do something about it. So we need to put our best to tackle this problem. I see a big improvement on this. I mean, the number of seizures we have, the numbers of arrests.
The trials of the drone have in fact proved such a success that it will now join the force on an almost full-time basis. The British base's territory will also be using hidden cameras, which is a method which has proved successful in recent months, leading to the prosecution of several bird trappers. Chris Packham says that this news is definitely positive.
I mean, signs are good here on the base, I have to say. It's early in the season. It's hitting peak migration now. They need to keep it up all the way through to the end of February, March, when the song thrush season ends. And if they do so, then I'll be putting my hands together to give them a jolly good round of applause.
It's now hoped that this new method of wildlife crime busts will make any wannabe poachers here in Cyprus think twice. Nathan Morley, Deutsche Welle, Decalia.
Well, we are going to go island hopping now from Cyprus all the way around the world, or halfway around the world anyway, to a group of islands that, if you're a fan of evolution, well, you know these islands very well. If you haven't guessed it already, I'm talking about the Galapagos, the archipelago that's about 1,000 kilometers, that's 600 miles, off the coast of Ecuador in South America. Now, this is the spot that inspired the English naturalist Charles Darwin to pen his theory of natural selection, which argues that mutations and traits that allow individuals to survive, those cause the broader population to change over time. And the key word there is over time. But now, researchers from the U.S. who've spent years on the Galapagos say that they've seen the birth of an entirely new bird species in as little as a few generations. On the phone with me now is Leif Andersson. He's the Swedish animal geneticist who sequenced the DNA of the birds involved in this study. Leif, this story actually begins in 1981. Can you take us back to 1981? What happened?
In 1981, Peter and Rosemary Grant was doing field studies on the small island of Daphne on the Galapagos, and they observed an immigrant male that came to the island and sang a different song compared with anyone else on the island, and it was different in morphology, but they were not sure about which species it was. But interestingly, this immigrant started to breed with one of the local species there, a female of the medium ground finch, and that was the start of this new lineage.
So the immigrant breeds with a local, and what happens next?
Well, the interesting thing was that the offspring of those did not mate with other medium ground finches, but they mated basically among themselves, so brother-sister matings, and started a new lineage that Peter and Rosemary Grant were able to follow for 30 years and over six generations, and they continued to mate within this particular lineage.
And that has now, at least today, resulted in a new species, a totally new species of bird?
So we say that it behaves as a new species. So, and the reason is this reproductive isolation, that it doesn't hybridize with any of the other. So there are three other species on this island, and this group, which we call the big birds, they keep to themselves and mate within that lineage. So from an ecological point of view, they behave as a distinct species on that island. But of course, this is a matter of definition. When do you decide to call a group of individuals as a new species? So.
Well, back when I was in high school, what I learned was that if one animal can mate and create offspring with another animal, then they are not, you know, part of different species, they're part of the same species. Now, I've since heard that that rule is not actually totally true. So my question is, are they really different species, or could they mate with native finches on the island?
Yeah, I mean, so this is mate choice that is taking place. And in the Darwin's finches, the thing is that the sons learn to sing the song like their father, and the daughters are imprinted to prefer males that sing the same song as their father. So this was certainly an important part in this, why they develop reproductive isolation so quickly. But they also do mate choice based on morphology, and apparently beak shape and size is an important factor. And these birds are unique compared with the other species on the island.
But if you force them to mate in a laboratory setting, they could mate, couldn't they?
I mean, I would be 100% convinced that they could, but they prefer not to. So, if you put them together, I'm sure that they would be able to mate, because they are, you know, very close related. So,
one thing that actually surprised me about the study was to hear that inbreeding amongst the big birds has led to a successful new species. I'd always thought that it led to genetic defects.
So it's much worse, you know, it's much worse for the population if you do brother-sister matings for many generations, so to speak. But if the population expand, that allow you lose some birds because of genetic defects, but the one surviving can continue to breed. So the population size was increasing from the first generation. So. But of course, they are a group of close related birds, of course. And that is well documented in our study, that we see that they become more inbred.
And again, that was Leif Andersson. He's the Swedish animal geneticist who sequenced the DNA of the birds in that study. Now, we are going to stay on the Galapagos Islands. They're very special islands. And in fact, more than 4,500 species live nowhere else but on these islands. And those are just the ones that have been discovered there already. There might be many more. But because of that biodiversity and because of the archipelago's historical significance, the islands have become a top destination for tourists. The problem is, centuries of tourism have slowly but surely contributed to the destruction of the very thing that people are going there to see in the first place, all of those animals. Michael Marek went there to find out more with a report told here by Natalie Mueller.
It's a still day. Only a couple of boobies and frigate birds swoop over the cruise ship. The cruise liner Silver Galapagos has dropped anchor next to Genovesa Island. It's only 8 o'clock in the morning, but it's already hot and humid. Genovesa is among the northernmost volcanic islands in the Galapagos archipelago, in the Pacific Ocean, about 1,000 kilometres off the coast of Ecuador. The first visitors to the area in the 16th and 17th centuries marvelled at the many tame birds that approached them and at the big lizards, turtles and sea lions that barely flinched when people walked up to them. But these newcomers would turn out to be a disaster for some of the local wildlife species. Today, the Galapagos giant tortoise is an endangered species. In the 16th century, there were more than 200,000 of these massive animals in the Galapagos. By the 1970s, just 3,000 were left. And today, the population is about 20,000. Several subspecies have already died out. Every year, tens of thousands of tourists enjoy the exclusive and expensive pleasure of visiting this secluded world on cruise ship tours, and their numbers are increasing. Axel Krumzik is a marine conservation expert with the Worldwide Fund for Nature, or WWF, in Germany. His area of responsibility includes the Galapagos Islands.
Invasive species are a huge problem for both flora and fauna. They're often parasites or microbes that are carried in from elsewhere. They could be in the ballast water of ships or in tourist luggage. The checks at the airport have improved significantly over the past few years, but the case of the mangrove finch is one example of what can happen. Today, the mangrove finch is on the brink of extinction. It's now one of the rarest birds in the world.
Einer der seltensten Vögel der Welt mittlerweile.
Since 2012, stricter rules have been enforced for trips to the Galapagos. Before then, cruise ships were allowed unrestricted access to the 13 main islands. Today, there's a 14-day rule. Any particular ship can only call at each of the 13 islands once every 2 weeks. But without tourism, the island's residents would suffer, says Galapagos guide Fernando Ortiz.
The Galapagos Islands is a $550 million a year business for Ecuador. Yeah, that's money is something that everybody understands. Basically, there is an interest from the Ecuadorian government and from many locals to keep the islands the way they are. Actually, conservation means trying to keep both ecosystems, the land and the marine ecosystem, viable and generating those processes that can support the life that we all come to see over here. If you ask any visitor to the Galapagos Archipelago what is their main expectation, they will tell you, oh, I want to see this animal or that animal and so on. Galapagos is not a zoo.
About 80 cruise ships are registered with the National Park Administration for landing rights, and only small ships with a shallow hull and no more than 100 passengers on board are allowed to explore the islands. The Park Administration also monitors the ship's routes by satellite.
We are just letting people know that Mother Nature rules. At least over here, she is the one that puts the conditions, she's the one to deliver the goods if she wants to do it. This is really a natural experience. You know, sometimes you get to see stuff, the stuff you actually paid your well-earned money to see, but some other times those animals you were expecting to find, they're just not there. You know, they decided to go someplace else for whatever reason, you know. It's really, for me, I think one of the messages we should try to convey to our guests.
Well, that brings this broadcast to a close for today. A special thanks to my technician today, Sophie Weber, and to you, all of our listeners, for tuning in. If you are not following us on social media, you should be. On Twitter, we are at @DW_SciTech. On Facebook, we are DW Science. We post a lot of stuff there that doesn't end up in the show. Lots of really interesting studies, lots of new developments in the SciTech world. I sincerely hope you come back next time for our next episode. And until then, and on behalf of all of my colleagues from the SciTech department here at Deutsche Welle, have a wonderful week ahead.